Well, but first, let's start with your full name, where you were born, when you were born, and the names of your parents.
Okay, I was born in January 6th, 1916, to Anna Oliver Orndorff and Christy S. Orndorff at Norwich, Ohio, about 4 miles out of the little city, which is probably 200 people. So I went to a neighborhood school and walked a mile to school. We had 8 grades in one room. And then I went to another school in Norwich, Ohio, 4 miles away, walking across the fields to that school every day. And then that school was closed, and I went to New Concord High School for the last 2 years in high school. And when I graduated from high school, I went to Muskingum College, which is in New Concord. And I went there for 4 years, and then I took an extra semester just because I didn't have a job and some things I wanted to take. And then I worked 2 years in college, and then stayed out a year and went back. I made some money and went back to school. And finished my Muskingum College with a degree, Bachelor of Science in Biology. And then I went to work in a cement plant for a while because I knew I was going to be drafted. And when I finally was drafted, I went into the Army. And I was allowed to go into the Army Air Corps as a weather student and then finally a weather observer. Served 4 years in the Southwest Pacific as a weather observer. 4 years, then I returned to Ohio State for 7 more quarters to become a landscape architect. I was given a job at the Ohio Department of Highways, a division landscape architect in Region 7. It was in Sydney, Ohio. I worked there for several years and then went to work for nursery as a landscape architect design, and worked there for a few more years, and then I went back to Zanesville, Ohio. I was married when I first came back, before I was discharged, and I married Maxine Hannes, and the girl I wrote to all the time I was in service. And then we had a couple daughters. They both live here now, incidentally. After I was working in the steel mill for a while then, waiting for an appointment to National Parks or as a landscape architect with the federal government. I finally became a landscape architect with the Daniel Boone National Forest, which was then a Cumberland. About a couple of years later, the Cumberland changed the name to Daniel Boone. Mm-hmm. And it's been Daniel Boone ever since. And I worked as a landscape architect, doing various jobs in the landscape business, such as designing district ranger office sites, recreation sites, picnic grounds and campgrounds, and laying out trails, and other jobs as assigned, such as designing clear cuts to become visually acceptable.
Well, let's stop there for a minute. So what attracted you to landscape architecture?
Well, I thought I wanted to be a doctor. Mm. I took 2 years of pre-med at Muskingum College, and I decided I wouldn't be a doctor for all the money in the world. So, I finally, after I graduated from Muskingum as a biology major. I still didn't know what I wanted to do, so I went to Ohio State to become a landscape architect. And it kind of fit together.
Why did it fit? I mean, what about landscape architecture? I mean, landscape architecture.
Well, plants and designing and residential planning. I did that for several years, working with nurseries.
Mm-hmm. And so you came into the National Forest Service because you had worked as a professional landscape architect?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
And I had taken exams in federal applications.
I see. Why did you want to work for the federal government as a landscape architect?
Well, I thought I'd do design, planning, and that sort of thing more than what I actually do. But my work turned out to be a lot of writing as well. Hmm. And with the writing, I did many analyses of sites suitable for development, or picnic grounds, or campgrounds, or whatever.
Mm-hmm. And so let's go back to some of your first memories of your day on the job when you first worked for the Forest Service, the Cumberland National Forest. Anything strike your mind?
Well, first I came from Zanesville by myself and went to the post office where the Forest Service was headquartered. In Winchester at that time, and I was the first one in the morning before the office opened. Well, I met Ruth Stafford, and she was a very pleasant lady and very, very pleasing. And then I later met the rest of the staff, but she was the first thing, and I decided then I would like it.
Yeah.
But in the Army, I was not one of these guys that hated the Army. I would like to go back and do it all over again if I could do the same things I did before.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't, of course.
And so do you remember your first... So what were some of your first projects you did for the Forest Service?
Well, some of the first projects was laying out an additional portion of the Estrie campground, which was very primitive, but one that had been built by what was it they called it? CCC, Conservation Corps workers, is one of the first projects that I had. And my boss was directly over me, was Joe Griffiths. And we were stationed in the McIldowney building on the fourth floor. And Joe was one of the most efficient men I've ever met, I think.
Awesome.
When the whistle blew at noon, no matter if Joe was dictating a letter, he put the microphone down and went home. When he came back, he'd pick up the microphone and say, right on. Now that never missed a beat.
Mm-hmm.
But the supervisor was Robert Collins. He was a retired Army colonel.
So what were some of those men like? I mean, those early Forest Service.
Well, they were very, very appreciative of what I did, and they let me do my job and did not attempt to boss every move I made, but they would be very open for suggestions and assistance if I needed any, which is something that not very many supervisors do. They want to tell you what to do and everything you do. But I was given pretty much of a free rein as to what I did.
Now, do you remember what year you started?
1962, in March, I think it was.
And can you say you started in for the tape? You started working at Cumberland National Forest in 1962.
62.
Mm-hmm. What were some of the jobs that people did in the Forest Service at that time?
Of course, the foresters did the forestry. They sold mark timber and sold it, and did reforestation as needed.
Now, what was the view on foot hiking, backpacking, that kind of stuff?
Well, there wasn't very much backpacking done in Nathaniel Boone at that time, because most of the trails were day trails. One day you would do it, so they didn't put backpacks and hike. But there were a lot of trails already existing when I came. Most of them were laid out by what the heck was his name? An assistant ranger in the Stanton district. I can see him, he was a good buddy. He and I were together when Kennedy was shot. We were up at Coomer Ridge laying out a campground that day.
So did you hike when you came into the Forest Service? Were you a much of a hiker?
I was not a hiker at all, and I'm still not a hiker. I wouldn't put a load on my back and be a dummy for anybody. Anyway, I enjoyed the working on the trail, and I did a lot of hiking, and it wasn't really hiking, but a lot of walking. I walked the entire trail and flagged it all out. Mm-hmm.
Before we get there, what were some of the things you did before you worked on the Sheltoe Trace, like some of your bigger accomplishments?
Well, I don't remember anything was really much of an accomplishment in the Forest Service before that.
Did you work in, like, did you lay out trails other than...
We laid out many, many campgrounds and built them, and I was on one or more of them about every day, assisting the district rangers and their crews, giving advice and working with them, mm-hmm. and maybe doing surveys of the site to develop a plan for. And the plans had to be submitted and approved in the region, which wasn't really necessary, I didn't think. But,
so what was your biggest project before the Sheltoe Trace?
Probably the largest campground was Coomer Ridge Campground. There was some at Rock Castle.
The Narrows,
Boot Dog. Okay. And there were probably 20 different campgrounds all over the forest. Some of different sizes. Some were just picnic grounds, and some were campgrounds where we had camping. But when we first developed the campgrounds, we did not anticipate developing them for trailers. I personally felt that was not a viable use of national forest property. But
what was it?
The use of campgrounds for trailers, I felt that was more of a private industry position than the national forest.
Why is that?
Well, that's just the way I felt about it. National Forest was, to me, was supposed to give a forest experience, and supposed to be done in the rough, more or less, rustic developments, mm-hmm. where everything fitted into the forest. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think trailer camping did, and I still don't.
Yeah.
Yeah, that to me is a private enterprise, and we shouldn't have been into it, competing with private industry.
Mm-hmm. And so...
Later it got to be, we had to develop in that way, against my wishes.
Now, what was your favorite, when you first came into the Forest Service and you were visiting all these different areas, what were some of your favorite areas?
Well, I think about Yehu Falls was one of the most interesting and probably the most scenic of all. Rodburn Hollow was a very, very nice development, but I think it's all public grounds now. I think the Forest Service probably gave it up. I don't know, but they're built so close to it that they probably might as well. There's camp buildings all around the thing. I hadn't been back there for 20 years, and I went past there the other day, and I was shocked at, that it was encrusted with all this private residence construction.
Yeah, it's right up there right next to it.
Have you been up there to Rodburn?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was a really nice campground, very convenient to the college and the people who would like to use a campground close to home. Coomer Ridge is one of the most used, I expect, of all of them, because it's in the Red River Gorge area.
Mm-hmm. Have you been? Oh, hey, this is. You're making noise.
Making noise. I guess I had something to play with.
Yeah. So, what was your. Red River Gorge, had you been to, I guess, Cave Run Lake, Laurel Lake? Did you have a preference of the lakes?
Well, I liked Laurel Lake better than Cave Run, really, because it didn't seem so commercial. Mm-hmm. Although there was the dam right there, and it was right near a nice big campground that we built.
Mm-hmm. Tully Bay.
Mm-hmm. And the water in it was always nice. Well, Cave Run is quite often just muddy.
Mm-hmm. Silty, muddy, yeah. It's shallow, whereas...
And full of trash and floating debris.
Mm-hmm. Now you were, let's talk about the Sheltoe Trace. Do you want to give, let's start with how it first came about.
Well, I was out in the forest one day and I met a group of Sierra Clubbers hiking around. I don't remember what they were on, I don't think they were on a trail, but I just happened to meet them, and this Dr. King's Oliver was the forest, was a Sierra Clubber, was there, and he or one of the men asked me if we had a trail that went from the north to the south end of the Danube. And that was the first time I ever thought about it, you know. And that sounded like a good idea. So you might say from that day forward, I planned trails that would connect to existing trails and they eventually could wind up as a complete trail. Mm-hmm. With that in mind. And finally at the last, it became a project approved by the forest supervisor, and I laid out the rest of it.
Now, why did you think it was a good idea?
Well, it seemed like something some people would really like to do, and it would be a trail that would attract a lot of people. And I have some friends that are great hikers, that they would probably like to hike it.
Now, what kind of people do you think would be, I mean, what kind of people did you have in mind would use it?
Well, most of these were backpackers that actually did backpacking, because I have an army friend that came with his family to visit with me, and they loved to camp and pack hike, and they would hike on this, the Appalachian Trail, trails like that, mm-hmm. and they were already in existence.
And so what did you see? So do you remember when this happened, when you saw these Sierra Clubbers?
I don't remember an exact date. No, it was in the early 60s sometime. Two, three, four, five along there. I don't know. I can't remember that. Mm-hmm. The dates didn't.
Now, what was... So describe some of the first things you did after you thought it was a good idea. How did you start building your trails or laying them out?
Well, of course, there were other trails that went to places that needed additional trails to give access. So we would contact those like Clear Creek Furnace. There was a trail that goes toward toward the Carrington Rocks, if you're familiar with those. And we finished laying out the trail out there, and then on south on the ridge tops from there to into the next county.
From Red River.
Menifee County? Yeah, the edge of Menifee.
In Wolf County, Menifee?
It was about Rowan County to Menifee, Menifee into, what's the next one?
Powell, Wolf,
Powell,
Lee.
Powell County.
Mm-hmm. Now, what were some, describe the trail network some more prior to you putting the Sheltoe Trace in.
Describe the trail itself?
I mean, what trails were around before the Sheltoe Trace?
Oh, there was quite a few trails in the Red River Gorge that Clarence Henson is the guy I was trying to think of a while ago. They had it laid out as a, he was a fire officer, I think, in the Stanton District. Clarence was, he laid out some pretty good trails in there that connected to sites like Swift Creek,
Swift Camp,
this rock bridge up Swift Creek, one down Swift Creek to the Parks Corner Creek overlook, and and trails like that.
Now you said it, he said he laid out good trail. What does that mean?
What's a good trail? I tell you in there what I thought about the trails. They had to have grades that were easy to hike, grades that would not be conducive to erosion, and trails that led to scenic spots, historic spots, places for refuge from storms, places where you could get food and water and make phone calls and get letters or mail letters or call for help or get first aid for injuries, and especially to get a resupply of water, because most of the trails, to be able to connect them together, you nearly always had to be on ridgetops, not down streams, because then they didn't take you anywhere.
What do you mean they didn't take you anywhere?
They would not go to any particular destination. They just come to a river or stream, and then you had a lot of stream bridges to cross and problems of construction and getting across the side streams and things like that when you follow a stream. Mm-hmm. And quite often the trail is very, the landslide is very steep next to the trail, and it makes a very expensive trail construction project. Mm-hmm. Hard to maintain and hard to circumnavigate.
Mm-hmm. Now you talked about some of the aspects that make a good trail. What kind of use do you see on a trail?
Hiking generally, and some hunters use them, and then too, the people who are seeking solitude and an experience of nature study, wildlife, and just enjoying the forest and being out where you can commune with nature and enjoy the forest as a forest.
Mm-hmm. Now, what do you think about the trails that were in the state parks?
Well, I helped some, help lay out some trails in state parks, like the Brakes Interstate. I went over there and helped lay out trails for a week one time. Mm-hmm. And they were very similar.
Well, how do you do that? How do you lay out a trail?
Well, to lay out a trail, usually you find a logical starting point where you have adequate parking or lodging where people can begin the day. And maybe if you want to be close to where you can get food and a good place to sleep and eat, that the state parks are very good. Now, the trails over there were neglected for a long time, and that's a really beautiful park. Mm-hmm. But we laid out maybe 10 miles of trail in there. But the way you lay out a trail usually is you get a roll of flagging and you tie it on this and that and as you go, and then the trail construction crew comes along and builds it.
Now, what do they do?
They have to dig in grades where you can make the trail so that it'll drain off and also so that it's not too steep to walk on. They have to put in water breaks if there's water exposed to run laterally with the trail.
Right.
We have to put a horizontal water break to turn the water, off.
Down the trail.
I noticed in this week the Raven Run Trail were asking for volunteers to help reconstruct parts of that trail. Mm-hmm. And I went over there and helped them at times. Hmm. And I helped lay out trails in the Jenny Wiley sections. And it was, we were cooperating with the other trail building.
So describe, pretend you're going back and you're starting your morning and you're going to lay out trail. Describe the tools you would use. You have your flagging, but you would have a map and all this.
Well, you always carried an ADNI level to keep our grades. You don't know what an ADNI level is? An ADNI level is a level that you can sight a point that's your head level above the ground, and it will give you a reading in percent elevation or declination from where you are. And we tried to keep them under 8%. That's 8 feet drop or rise in 100 feet, so that the trails weren't too steep and you wouldn't get a lot of water accumulating or running fast on the trail.
Would you have a compass?
Never used a compass.
Why not?
I had topo maps. I had topo maps that showed me where I was, where all the breaks in the land were, and where the streams were, and also from which you started and to where you were going to go.
Mm-hmm. Now, for people that don't know, what is a topo map?
A topo map is a map that is a group of lines that are at certain intervals, like 20 feet, 40 feet, or 60 feet, depending on the area that you're mapping, above sea level. Now, the maps, these topo maps are made by the USGS Geological Survey or something. They they map the whole United States. You can get a topo map. You can go to the mostly the offices that sell them.
Geological survey offices.
Yeah, and you can get them from the highway department sometimes, or different farm organizations have them. If you want a topo map of your farm, you can get one. And right now I'm working on a trail with the Muskingum County Fair Board, laying out a trail in the fairgrounds that will be used for hiking, walking, nature study, or maybe even exercise trails. But I hope not ever have any horses or wheeled vehicles.
Now, why is that?
Because horses make fat tracks with their feet. They also drag their hind feet going down a grade, and they cause erosion.
Now hold up. See,
and the tracks fill with water, and they stir up the soil, make it erode easily. And they also drop doo-doo every so often in the trail, which people don't like to walk in that.
Or smell it.
Oh, well, I don't worry much about the smell outside. But the wheeled vehicles channel the water if they go down the trail and cause it to get in quantities that will cause erosion very quickly. I have seen in 1 year's time where these guys did this hill climbing with their wheeled vehicles, ditches 6 and 8 feet deep.
That's,
tell me that won't happen on a trail. I know you're lying.
You're probably thinking of Kroomer Ridge. It's south of I-75. It's where the Sheltoe crosses the I-75.
Mm-hmm.
It has ruts that are as deep as that door right there to the bedrock.
Mm-hmm.
And your trees were just hanging, off. Now the horses. Now I'm sorry. I kind of got lost. Can you describe the damage a horse does?
He drags his feet going downhill, his hind feet.
Why is that bad?
That causes him to slide and loosens the soil and makes it very easy to erode with a rainfall.
And a horse that can walk through a lot of mud.
The horses also make mud in the trail where they footprints are. They'll stand full of water and they make walking for a hiker very, very unhappy. Mm-hmm. You probably have walked in some of them.
Yeah, and then in the wintertime that freezes and the whole thing kind of makes this big mound, and it kind of, because water expands when it freezes, and then it kind of grows. One small spot will...
Yeah, well, the horses also are as sort of an intrusion on the solitude factor and the natural communing of a person. And the ORVs, of course, they make noise and they make ruts, and they are very, very obnoxious to the hiker.
Mm-hmm. Now what about the mountain biker, the pedal bikes?
Well, they have wheels on them too. They also make dirt channels.
Mm-hmm.
And they destroy fragile ecosystems if they get off the trail. Mm-hmm. And they cause the runoff water to carry silt that also destroys the ecosystem, changes the factor.
And streams down the hill. When you were laying out trails, what was your philosophy for use? I mean,
well, I envisioned them mostly as hiking for either a day hike or an extended backpack trip, either one, and for nature study, mm-hmm. and to get you to see some of these interesting sites like the what do I call it? Like the Swift Creek Dam, Rock Creek Bridge, mm-hmm. Rock Bridge, they call it. Mm-hmm. Those things you cannot see without hiking to get there. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's a lot of cliffs that are very interesting. You can study the geology of the place and all that sort of stuff.
Now, the Sheltoe Trace, when did it become a reality?
It tells you in there, 1979, June 23, I think it is. It gives it in here. Yeah, June 23, 1979. That was when they had the dedication ceremony.
What happened?
They had a dedication ceremony.
Describe that day.
Well, that was the meeting of all the people interested in the trail and the Undersecretary of Agriculture came out and officiated at the dedication and awarded me a certificate of appreciation for, it tells you all that, it's in full detail in there.
Mm-hmm. What did that mean to you?
Well, I got a whole $25 savings bond from the force. Can you imagine that? Another guy I know got a $50 savings bond for saying, let's use magic markers on survey stakes.
Why?
Where's the justice? And I probably spent hundreds of my hours of my own time working long hours.
Thought I had this off. Okay.
Let's try again.
Yeah, well, it's off now. talk about, the work that went into doing the Sheltoe Trace when you were doing it full time.
Well, I would go to a certain place to start, and on my map, I would draw a line. I'm going to work on this section today, and I would start here. Maybe it was in the Stearns area or wherever, and we'd follow this line on the topo map to get to where we were going that day, and tie ribbons every 50 or maybe 200 feet, depending on how thick the growth was in that particular area. Sometimes you had to tie them fairly close, and sometimes you could stretch it out a bit. You tie a piece of flagging, maybe usually used orange flagging, and tie them about head high so they're easily visible.
And now you say you drew a line on a map. Did you look at the terrain first and say, okay, I think we need to put a trail?
Well, the map gives you what the terrain is going to be, how steep it is or where. How much you have problem you're going to have with cliffs and crossings of water streams and things like that, highways. We had to lay out the map on to try to get to an area where you could cross, like I-64 there by Moorhead. The trail came to where there was an overhead bridge that you could cross over without having to get into the highway traffic. And then at Cumberland Falls State Park, at the crossing of the river there on the bridge, at Laurel River Dam, it crosses the dam there. Cave Run Dam, it crosses below the dam or by the dam. I guess they cross on the dam there.
On the dam. Were those all your choices?
Hmm?
Were those all of your choices? Did you make the decision to cross the dam?
I made all those decisions. Every decision ever made on anywhere on that trail, I made it. And every private land that we had to cross, I had to make the connection with the landowner.
Was that ever tough?
That was one of the toughest parts of all. It took lots of tact and a lot of talking sometimes, but most of the men were very agreeable, as long as it was enforced. They didn't seem to mind, and the only one I had trouble with was south of Moorhead. After you cross the Route 32 going into Moorhead, it came down onto the highway there, and it should have gone across and down the ridge clear down to
Triplet.
It's a Triplet Creek, yeah. But instead, the guy would not give us a right of way. No way would he give a right of way. And I don't know if I've ever been able to buy anything since I retired. I retired 25 years ago.
When was that?
1980.
Wow.
And that was a long time ago. Anyway, they made lots of changes since I retired, I'm sure.
Any ones you approve of?
I don't even follow the trail anymore. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Why not?
I don't really want to know if they changed it.
Why?
Because I wanted it like it was.
What was it like?
It was all done with my philosophy of where the trail should go and why it should go there and what should be done to make the proper connections there. But now, like at Triplet Creek, you know, they built a bridge for us there. The bridge crossed a mint. You could cross the bridge with a semi almost for a trail, and all I wanted was maybe a swinging bridge. $500 instead of $50,000.
A swinging bridge is $500?
Probably. Could have been built for $500.
Why was that bad?
Well, it was bad because it allowed these horses and vehicles to cross. It did damage to the trail everywhere, and it also ate up a lot of money, which wasn't necessary, and it took it away from the primitive experience that the trail hiker wants. He wants some hardships. He wants some trying areas. Now, at the Laurel River Dam, I think you had to wade across the dam spillway in some water, and it might be slippery. But it was able to get across just the same. Mm-hmm. But those are the things that I think hikers like to enjoy, those little hardships. Maybe there are some older people that might not appreciate that if they're grandmothers or something, but they also hike. A lot of them do.
Grandmothers?
Yeah. We had a trail crew from the Stearns District. A lot of women worked on the trail down there. They had a trail hiking club.
So what were those people like? What were the hiking clubs like when you were designing?
Well, I don't know. I never hiked with them, but they were people that were interested in the trail and they wanted to see a good trail built.
Now, you were talking about your philosophy. The trail was aligned by your philosophy. Can you summarize? I mean, can you talk about where your philosophy, where you saw it in the trail with examples? Like, you talk about Triple Creek, but do you have other examples?
Well, there are lots of places where we had to insert switchbacks. And switchbacks aren't good if you can see the trail from above or below, and because people will cut across. And when they cut across, you get erosion, and you get problems, and you get construction costs, and you get damages that you just can't repair.
Yeah. And
but sometimes they are necessary. So you try to either make them where you can't see it, or make them so gentle that they do not object to crossing and following the trail.
Like at I noticed at Cave Run, there's switchbacks that are very long and gentle, and you really can't, they're hard to cut, to cut the switchback, because they're so long and gentle mm-hmm. that you just stay on the trail.
Well, that's the idea, that you make it so that that it's so easy to keep on the trail that you don't want to be climbing up and down. Although, if you can see it, there are people that will, they're natural cheats, I guess. They want to cheat the system.
Even if it's maybe more difficult to jump over bushes and rocks when you have a nice, clean trail, that it's only going to save you maybe 5 seconds. You know, like cutting.
No, but they just naturally want to. You can see that on the trails across the campuses at the universities. They won't follow the path if they can go straight.
Mm-hmm. A deer path, they call them, where they create their own path, the shortest distance between two points.
Well, those are the things you have to guard against. But
what are the best parts of the trail?
The what?
What are the best parts of the parts of the trail that you enjoy the most?
Well, the scenic spots and the geological study areas, the arches and the waterfalls and things like that that are exciting to see. Maybe something of historical note. Some of them are old. Mill Creek dams and things like that, where you dams and water wheels and log floats, all that stuff. Where they call them flash dams, I think they call. They can pull out a plug and let a whole lot of water go down the river with a big load of logs on it.
Huh. And what would that do?
That would save them a lot of dragging timber out with mules and going up and down steep grades with them, but they could float it out like Swift Creek, and the water at the Rock Creek Bridge there. There's a little waterfall upstream about 100 yards. At the top of that was a flash dam where they had a dam that they could pull a post out and let the dam go, and it would filled up with logs, and then the logs would go down. Usually, sometimes men would ride on the logs and keep them from clogging up. And
how deep would they dam it?
I don't know how deep they were, but they must not have been too awfully deep. But
yeah, I mean, if enough power to move these logs,
let the water build up a mass of water that would carry them down, when a river normally didn't have that much water in it.
So what were some of the other historical sites you put the trail by?
Well, there was a moonshiner cave where we developed a still site with whiskey barrels and jugs and thump tanks and all that stuff in it. We put a chain link fence across that one just below Rock Bridge, about, well, maybe half a mile or so.
Now, is that up on the, can you see it from the creek?
No, I don't think so. It's off the trail, a little bit, the side trail goes to it.
Okay.
But it's signed, still, I think.
Now, what about that furnace?
The old rock furnaces that, like Clear Creek Furnace. That was an interesting place to stop and view that. I was there one day with a couple from the district, and we looked up at that old furnace, and there's a rattlesnake had come out about 10 feet high and turned back into the rocks with his head back in there. And I said, I think I can take this pole and reach up there and put it through that loop of snake and haul him out of there. Well, I put the pole through the snake and went to give it a flip, and the snake was tucked in there pretty tight, and he broke the pole in two. He could have come down on my head. But it was kind of a funny thing. Yeah. It was a rattlesnake.
Yeah, that's, well, some people might say that's funny. Other people might not.
That's another thing. I usually had to wear snake leggings, because some of these trails were through very thick brush, and you couldn't see whether you were stepping on one or not.
Now, how tough was that? I mean, some of those trails are tough, even with the trail going through it. I can't imagine flagging
them. Well, that took time, and you'd do that several times before you would find a route that you could go through a laurel thicket and not run into a cliff that rose up and shut you off, because the interim between the contour lines, it didn't always show every little hump that goes in there. Mm-hmm. 20 feet can be a big jump, and between the next line it might go up and down like that.
Even 10 feet might be, it won't show it on the map, but it'll stop you in your tracks.
Yeah, but you couldn't walk up that. You didn't want people to have to climb up a cliff or subject themselves to places where snakes might be able to hide behind the rocks and when you go by.
Now, what's the story of the suspension bridges?
The suspension bridge? Well, there's a lot of ways to build them. You can build a suspension bridge with two cables, one to walk on and one to hold on to. One four feet above, five above the other one. You walk on one, or you can make a tread with cross planks on the bottom one, with maybe two handrails on the top, and walk on a solid bridge. You've been across the one at Red River?
Well, there's a couple. There's Red River, there's one at Triplet, at Holly Creek, at down at Sinking Creek. There's a whole bunch of them.
Yeah, well.
Suspension bridges.
They're not too hard to build, really, but they are kind of scary if you're like the one at Red River. That was pretty high. Chester Morrison built that one. You know Chester? You might want to interview him.
What kind of character is he?
He was a district worker from the Stanton District. Chester lived just under Chimney Top Rock. Have you ever been up on that? And there's a house down below.
Okay.
That's where he lived. And he went down and across that swinging bridge. Sometimes the water was low enough he could ford the stream with his car, but usually he had to leave it out across the river.
That's river, yeah. Now, why did he live up there? Because is that just where he lived?
Well, his wife, I don't know whether her father or who owned that property, but she inherited it and he lived there. And his wife died now, 4 or 5 years ago. She was a good friend of ours, and we played games with Chester and Dottie. And Chester was a good construction man.
So he built that bridge he had help, I guess.
I guess he built it by himself. I don't know if anybody helping him or not, but
that's a pretty high bridge.
Yeah. Chester. He did live in Danville, but I don't know. I think he's moved to I don't know where he lived now. I've got his address at home, but I...
Now, did you make a choice to use suspension bridges, or was that just something?
I left it up to the district to build whatever bridges they needed. Mm-hmm. Some of them built the bridges, some of them built the steps, stair steps, and some of them didn't. The worst one was the one that competed with Cave Run Dam. They neglected to build stairways up from Route 32, which should have been built right off, but never was. I don't think they've built them today yet. And that's a hard way to come down that to the highway, which is another case of where getting an easement wasn't the easiest thing in the world. The trail was originally to come down halfway down the hill towards Morehead from 64 on that side of the hill. And the lady down there would not give us a right of way.
Why not?
I don't know. I think she wanted to tell she could sell it for a fortune. Maybe she could, I don't know.
And so what about some other areas along, like let's start from the south. Did the trail end at Kentucky, or did it go all the way to Pickett State Park?
Well, there was an existing road from the end of the trail just past Peter's Mountain or Parker's Mountain.
Peter's Mountain, there's two mountains.
Peter's Mountain, like I said, I slept there in that tower one night. But the trail goes just a little bit farther out the ridge from that and comes to the state line. And from there on to Pickett State Park, there was an old road that it followed into the state park.
Mm-hmm. That was along Rock Creek?
Well, no, it was up on the ridge.
Up on the ridge?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
And, now it goes down, when you start at the southern terminus.
I think they did move it down there to follow up Rock Creek.
Yeah, and it's on an old railroad grade. And you have to cross Rock Creek twice there, and that can be kind of dangerous because it waters high. It's a fast stream. But it's also a beautiful stream, too.
Yeah, Rock Creek is a beautiful stream. Incidentally, the Walnut Grove Picnic Ground, I guess it's campground. Was it a campground or picnic ground up there? Campground, I guess. The ranger had a big briar patch out there in a big open field. And he decided that he would get rid of the briar patch by using some herbicides. So he went out there and sprayed with herbicides. And it was a hot, sunny day. And the stuff vaporized and blew across and killed several acres of forest across Rock Creek.
That's pretty powerful stuff.
It is. You know, that trees are not very well protected against herbicides. Usually a lot of people kill their trees in town. Spraying the grass kill.
Didn't know that. That's pretty interesting.
Now you got to be very careful when the sun's out.
Now, what about, so you go up from Hemlock Grove, and that's when you get to the top of Peter's Mountain. Describe that.
Well, I don't remember that particular placement.
Yeah. You said you slept up in the fire tower?
Yeah, I slept in the fire tower, but we were fishing down there in Rock Creek for trout. We ate trout, cooked on a piece of foil on a fire grate. Good. I think we finally made the trail come down to Rock Creek then, went up close to the shores of Rock Creek, going up, and I remember now going down there with Jim Spear from the Corps of Engineers and laid out trails that went on into Pickett.
Thompson Creek?
I don't know what the name of the creek is up. Yeah. Rock Creek.
Now, so you're coming down Peters, you leave Peters, you're on Laurel Ridge, and you go down into some private property, and you eventually make it. Do you remember crossing Rock Creek, the final place right by the Big South Fork? The Big Ford there?
I remember we needed a crossing there just up a little bit from the mouth of Rock Creek in the Big South Fork. And I don't think there was any bridge ever built while I was there.
Still not. No. And it's kind of funny because when you get to that end of Rock Creek, from all the acid mine drainage, it's completely red just at that part. But when you up there at the campground, it's a trout stream. It's just pure water. And you trout.
And yeah, well, see, there's a lot of mining done on what I call this side of Rock Creek up on the ridge tops. There's a lot of that mine acid came down. There was a lot of spoil banks that were on fire, and the smoke from the fire killed many, many acres of national forest above those, along the ridge tops.
So it was in pretty bad shape back then.
Yeah. But we didn't put the trail in any of those spots.
And now what about Yamacraw Bridge? Remember Yamacraw?
I remember Yamacraw, but I don't remember anything about the bridge.
Okay. Now, we're heading up towards Negro Creek and then to Yahoo Falls. Yahoo Falls. Which way do you pronounce it?
I call it Yahoo.
Yahoo.
The falls itself is... That's an interesting overhang. You realize that overhang is an area almost as large as a football field.
Didn't know that.
It's pretty big. And the falls themselves are 116 feet high. Of course, there's not much water most of the time. Mm-hmm. You could probably, if you had to pee as bad as I do sometimes, you could probably overdo it.
Now, do you remember anyone? Now, what was that? I mean, was that a pretty nice area when you went through there?
Well, we did a lot of development in there with trails all around in the side of that Yahoo Falls area. And then I guess it's now managed by the Corps of Engineers. There was a They gave that part away. I don't know why the Forest Service did that, but
it's now actually a national park. It's a national recreation.
Yeah.
Area. And do you ever remember anyone falling off Yahoo or Yahoo Falls or?
Did I remember what?
People falling off those high water.
No, I never heard of anybody falling off. Yeah. There was a place on the top, right close to where the water comes over. We had a little retaining wall built, and we used to walk out and look over this little retaining wall, and there'd be some, I believe, copperheads down on the ledge before it went over the bank. Yeah. Nearly every time you go to look.
Mm-hmm. You see a snake. And so, what about do you remember like going up to US 27? Up there by Stearns Ranger District?
27, I see, where did we cross that?
You cross a railroad, big tracks. It's just north of Stearns Ranger District on 27. It went down to Barren Fork Horse Camp. Just south of Cumberland Falls?
Well, when we come out of Cumberland Falls, we come around and crossed over a pretty big stream and came up an old log road out. I can't remember now what the thing went.
Well, here, let's switch gears here. I just have a couple more questions. Who named it Sheltoe Trace? Who named it Sheltoe Trace?
Well, I think that was a contest, and I don't know who named it Sheltoe, but Sheltoe means big turtle, and to the Indians, that was their name for him. and I don't know who just called it that, but I think it was Bob Strosmeyer wanted to call it a trace. I don't know what trace means to him, but it doesn't mean anything to me.
Why would you want to call it?
I just want to call it a trail. Mm-hmm. And that's what it was. It wasn't somebody's path that you took over, or a path that led to some particular something, because it doesn't. It just goes that. There is nothing at the end of it that you want to visit, especially on the north end. It just stops at the end of the forest. And there's nothing there that would induce you to walk the trace to get to it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. No goal.
Yeah, it's just a little marker on the road. That's the northern terminus.
Well, they probably put one there, but it wasn't there when the trail didn't lead to that marker.
Yeah, well, you can't walk up there now because of the ice storm damage from a couple of years ago.
Oh.
You have deadfall that's, you know, probably 3-4 feet deep. And I think they want to close part of the Sheltoe up there.
Well, you know, the trail right south of the Vanceburg Inn there was a lot of land owned by the Mead Paper Company that adjoined the National Forest just at the ridge top. You had to kind of be careful you didn't cross into the paper company. But I don't think they would have really objected to the trail being on national or on paper company land, but they may not have been much in favor of protecting it.
I mean, because they raised trees for pulp.
For paper, pulp wood.
And so do you know Don Figg?
Yes, quite well.
Describe.
Don Figg is a one of a kind. He is a weightlifter supreme. He really was a muscle man. And he did a lot of weightlifting, and he was a great guy for working with search and rescue for the National Forest, climbing the cliffs and all that sort of thing, and pulling people off the cliffs that got hung up there. And Don's a great guy, and I don't know, he worked with me a lot, so he was a real good friend, but I really don't know why he won't retire.
He's still working there.
I think he's one of these guys that thinks he wouldn't know what to do if he retired. I never missed Forest one day after I retired. I went out and played golf for 10 years in a row and had a great time. And then they closed the depot and I rode it for 10 years.
And what's the depot?
The Avon. You know the Army depot?
Where at?
At Avon, halfway between here and Lexington.
Oh, okay, yeah. That's where you play golf?
That's where I play golf. It was a an Army depot. And they had a golf course with 8 or 9 holes. And I got permission from them to play golf on their golf course for the Forest Service people. But I think I was the only one that ever played.
Well, that's a pretty good deal you got.
Well, we didn't get to play for free, but we had to pay a green fee. Membership cost me, I think, $75 for a year. Play all I wanted to, so every day except Saturdays, Sundays, and holidays. Mm-hmm. And I had friends that we played 2 or 3 times a week. And
so what else do you do since retirement?
Well, since retirement, I spent a lot of time writing novels. And then I got to writing poetry, and I have a book full of poems. one copy of it in here with 387 of my poems in it.
A lot of poetry. Well, so what about, I mean, can you, do you remember any of your poems, or what were they?
Oh, about? I remember one I can give you.
Okay,
I call it The Green Peach. Green as grass, hard as a bullet. Stupid ass, why did you pull it?
Okay, here, let's back up again here.
But some of them are pretty long. Most of them are moralistic or giving solutions to problems and good advice to young people and old people. And some of them are just humorous like that one. And some of them are just what this old fogey thinks about that.
So you call yourself a poet now?
No.
Well, if you write poems.
But I have five full book-length novels I've written. I haven't published any of those. But I did publish the book this last January. I paid for it myself, a self-publishing, I guess you call it. And I had 200 copies, and they went so quick, and I've been trying to decide whether I want to be able to make another printing or not. I sold them for $20 a piece, and some people say they should have charged them more. they are good poems, and most of them are very, very good. I got, I think, one left that I haven't promised somebody.
So what's the name of the book?
Poems for Living, Laughing, and Learning.
Well, I think we're pretty much there.
There's some things in here. I want you to be sure to read that thing that we didn't cover.
Well, like what?
Like who all were involved in the
building the trail
construction, finally, in the last page.
Well, let's talk about that.
Where it talks about the dedication ceremony.
Okay. Well, here, let me.
They were never officially closed. It hadn't maybe been used for 20 years.
What was that?
Trees this big in the middle of them. Old roads through private lands where we could get a right-of-way. And I was able to convince the local county governments to give me a right-of-way as long as the trail was needed there. Tell us about it.
Now here, you make a little bit of noise with this. Here, I'll just read through this and ask you some questions. So why were horseback riders not likely to work on trails?
Mostly because they're lazy. They want to ride. That's why they ride horses.
That's a good point.
And the same thing is true of the off-road vehicle rider. They're not going to go out and volunteer to build trails. And that's why there was one time when these volunteers were practically the only maintenance that got the trail. That was on the trail, was volunteers. But when you got horse manure and mud and noise and the experiences are shot, these people aren't going to volunteer either.
And it's kind of ironic because a horseback rider can carry in tools. And they seem like they could, you know.
Well, you can also carry them in on your back, like.
Yeah. But I noticed that in parts of, especially Cave Run, where there's a lot of horseback use, tree falls over, and the horseback people go around that tree. And so they'll create terrible erosion around the tree. But they could easily pack in a chainsaw on their horse and just cut through that tree to get through.
Yeah, don't look for that.
Yeah.
It just doesn't happen.
Now what's a Honda?
A Honda is one of the favorite riding ORVs, Hondas, and that's the only one I can think of. It rhymed with horses and Hondas and hikers.
So which is your favorite?
Well, I'm favorite hikers. Of course, they hike because they enjoy the forest experience.
Got a cramp?
Cramp in my hind leg.
Hikers, horses, and Hondas. Did you come up with that?
I had that title on here, and I messed it up. I started getting this stuff, and I couldn't get my word processor to quit.
Now, describe that term again, just so we have it on tape. Describe that term. I want you to say it. Describe what it means.
What?
Hikers, Hondas.
Hikers, horses, and Hondas. That's the conflict is between hikers, horses, and Hondas.
How so?
And that's the reason that the trail maintenance volunteers dried up.
Mm-hmm. And the conflict was because?
Because the horses and Hondas are not compatible with hiking.
Now, who are desk jockeys?
Disc jockeys? Well, there's the forest supervisor, the regional forester, and the chief of the Forest Service in Washington. You know, they sit at desks and they don't know really what goes on the ground.
And so they think it's a good idea?
Well, they have been sold on the multiple use concept. If the forest is used not just for forestry, but for recreation, for water quality, for various other things besides timber and all these things. You know, the timber is very important, and the water watershed protection is another thing very important. River quality
but you don't think people should just take their ORVs out there, and do you think that's not a suitable multi-use for the Forest Service?
No.
Because it makes getting rights-of-ways even more difficult, doesn't it? It makes getting right-of-ways more difficult, doesn't it, when you have to convince a landowner to allow them to let not just hikers.
Well, you see, when the trail was laid out, they envisioned the trail as a hiking trail, not as a horse trail or an ORV highway. And of course, it caused a lot of animosity between the landowner and the Forest Service.
When
the Forest Service decided, after the trail was all laid out and they'd given the permission to use their land as a right-of-way, that they would introduce horses and off-road vehicles, which were not in their thinking when they gave the land right-of-way. Probably they wouldn't any of them have given it.
Mm-hmm. Now, so when the trail opened, it was foot travel only. Mm-hmm. And how long did that last?
Oh, I don't know. It didn't last very long, but you know, there's a lot of people that wanted to ride their Hondas and their trail bikes. You see them on television all the time. No wonder they think it's okay.
And so we're sitting here. This is pretty good. Now, who were some of the different groups that helped build the trail?
Well, the Sierra Club, the Stearns Hiking Club are mentioned in there as groups. Then there were CCC kids, and they were Happy Pappies, and they were Green Thumbers, and people like that They didn't all of them, but that's some of them.
What's a Happy Pappy?
That's old. It's a program for old people.
Yeah.
Maybe they're out of work and destitute. The government gives them a job and doing that stuff.
Now, what I want to figure out is how did you come up with the number 254 miles?
I measured it on the map. Well, that is a figure that the forest put on. I think they cut off the section that goes in to 7 miles to Pickett.
Now, but how did you measure it? I mean, did you take and just measure it on a...
I mean, on the map wheel.
No, I'm sorry, let's back up.
A map wheel.
Say that you measured the trail, say just so people, so I can use it for editing. Say, I measured the Sheltoe Trace on a map to this, to whatever it is.
Well, I made it with a map wheel on a map, and I did 265 miles, I think. And then I think maybe they had somebody actually walked it with a wheel on the ground, and they got 254 miles. But I don't think they walked the portion in Tennessee.
So someone walked the entire Sheltoe Trace with a wheel?
Probably.
And,
you'd have to ask somebody else about that. I don't know, but
I measured with GIS and I came up with around 260 for including the part that went into.
You may have missed some loops. You know, yeah. It's hard to get it with the exact measurements because the curves and everything causes your wheels to not record all the actual distance.
Tight turn it won't.
As you did with the actual wheel on the ground.
Mm-hmm. And then you go uphill, you can't record all that. It's just a little bit, but it adds extra distance. How do you think the trail has changed today?
I don't know. I haven't been on the trail today.
Yeah.
I haven't walked any of it, you might say, in the last 25 years.
Are you worried that it might not be what you hope for?
No, I'm not worried about it at all.
Yeah. Now, I have one last question.
I think one of these somebody's going to smarten up and take the horses, the Hondas, off of it.
I think the London Ranger District probably won't do that. I think the Stanton Ranger District. Were the Ranger Districts as independent then as they are now? They seem to have their own. Each district
well,
is its own.
No, I don't think so. I think they were all part of the force then. And the supervisor's office gave the direction for all districts. And the district ranger did as he was allowed to do under the supervisor's regulations.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems like today there's a lot of leeway with what a district can do.
Like, I don't know.
Yeah, like London Ranger District, was that around when you were there?
Yes.
A lot of the Sheltoe Trace is open to all uses. Even some of it is even street legal cars that are in the woods, and it probably disturbs.
Well, you know, I think that probably is because of the one area south of Livingston. A little bit, where you come to the top of the hill, and there's a bridge over I-75, I think, there.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a section south of that where it goes on some old roads. And I think they get in there and probably...
Yeah. That's called Croomer Ridge. They call that Croomer. And it's, as far as you can see, they're all over the place. And, And these ORV people think they have a right to go anywhere because mm-hmm. it's the Forest Service. Now, the horse people, horses, as you know, in Kentucky are sacred.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. See, the guy interviewing me even has a horseshoe for a...
That's true. But I don't have a horse for my horseshoe to go on. This is my foot. Well, this one last thing. What did you design to mark the trail with?
A turtle. A little, about this tail to 3.5-inch metal stencil disc with, so that when you stenciled it with a stencil brush, you had a turtle showing that would identify the trail as Sheltowee, so that you, if you got off that, you knew you were not on Sheltowee anymore. Mm-hmm. And that was stenciled on trees and rocks and things like that, where you couldn't carry the signs away, which is a lot of, you know, if you have a unique sign, people are always trying to steal it.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you design that stencil?
Yes.
Can you just say for the microphone that you designed?
How's that?
Just say that. See, people will listen to this, and they won't hear me ask you a question. So you have to say.
Hello. Yeah, I designed that turtle design to make it identify the Sheltowee trace, which means big turtle in Indian talk. And that is the name of the trail because of Big Turtle. Because the Daniel Boone National Forest was named after Daniel Boone or the Big Turtle. Although Daniel Boone never walked on this trail, or never walked in that direction of the trail anywhere that I know of.
He might have crossed it. He had to cross it.
He may have crossed it a lot of places, but probably never actually walked on any of it in any distance.
So, was it hard to design that little turtle?
The what?
The turtle, was it hard to design it?
No, I just cut out the circles, like the spots on the turtle's back. You know, you've seen land turtles, I expect a lot of them. And they are very distinctive markings on their back and their head. So that,
and you cut that paper and then you...
I made it out of metal stencils, so that they could use it over and over and over and over with a stencil brush. You know what a stencil brush is. It's a brush that's real round and it's got real stiff brushes, and you dab it on some stiff paint like you make a stencil.
Yeah,
okay. And you dab it and it dabs on enough paint and you can actually get the design from that without running, or you don't have to be an artist to draw a turtle every time.
Yeah. Good point. For one more time, say that I designed the Sheltowee Trace.
I designed the Sheltowee Trace emblem in the form of a stencil turtle that could be posted on the trails, on trees and rocks and alongside the trail and other permanent fixtures.
Mm-hmm. That's fine. Did you think a lot about Daniel Boone when you were out there?
No.
No.
No, I didn't think about Daniel Boone. I don't think I ever thought about Daniel Boone.
A lot of people do when they're out there hiking the trail. A lot of people think that they're walking, you know, that they're somehow communing with that history.
Have you ever been to the Boone, cave up in Red River Gorge? You've been down to see that?
Yeah.
Where he was supposed to have wintered the winter in this rock house, with an interior rock house that... very small, but they left this. If you've been in the Forest Service, there's a shingle that was in there that says D. Boone on it, whether he made it or not, but it was found in that enclosure.
Mm-hmm. Now it's all fenced in. You can't get back there. When you walk down there, the entire rock house is fenced in from edge to edge.
Yeah.
And there's a little wooden walkway.
Well, and also there were troughs of wood that were found there. They were supposed to have been used somehow in making gunpowder from nitre. Mm-hmm. It's usually you find in these caves.
Mm-hmm. Well, great. I think we're going to wrap it up here. Do you have anything you want to add? I can always get back in touch with you if you think.
Well, Shelton, I would just like to add that the horses and the Hondas are not compatible with hiking trails. Mm-hmm. End of quote.
Yeah.
For all the reasons I gave you in there.
Well, that's why when I read the article in the Herald.
Well, you can quote anything in there you want to that I've said, and I don't pull any punches.
Yeah.
I mean.
Well, what we're going to do is.
I'm the only one that flagged any part of that trail in the original.
What, say that again?
Except the sections that were already existing.
Yeah. Well, say that again.
I'm the only one that did any flagging on that trail, except for the trails that already existed.
Mm-hmm. And so,
which were done mostly by Clarence Hansen in the Red River area.
And
there's another one that goes from Cumberland Falls State Park up to the mouth of Laurel River Creek, mm-hmm. Laurel River. That's about 12 miles long. It was already there.
Yeah. That's probably a popular, because Cumberland Falls was probably built in the 30s.
It was probably done when they built the lodge. You know, the lodge was built by CCC workers, I think. You know, it's real rustic. It was built back in those days, mm-hmm. when CCC was a popular. Mm-hmm.
And it's a beautiful trail, too, that little section. You go past Dog Slaughter Falls.
There's one place on that trail about halfway from one end to the other where they found a man and his wife and a small child living under a rock overhang. When I was working with the Forest Service.
Huh. What were they doing?
They were living there. That was their home. They just squatters. They just came out and lived under that rock.
Well, how would they go eat?
Well, I suppose they'd go out and get something to eat, maybe, but that was their home.
Hmm. Well, it was done in the past. I could probably do it today.
Well, there's a lot of people that do funny things.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you feel a sense of pride about the Sheltoe Trace?
What?
Do you feel proud?
Well, I was proud of it because it represented perhaps maybe a year's work altogether. And a lot of days I would work 10 hours instead of 8, and if quitting time come and I had another mile to go to get to my destination, I didn't quit and go home. I stayed and finished it. And if I had to go to Ohio to get a crossing right away, I went and got it from people who owned the land that lived up there. Mm-hmm. Those things, they didn't figure on when they gave me a $25 savings bond mm-hmm. for my efforts.
Mm-hmm. Now, it says in here that it was the 100th Forest Service National Recreation Trail. What does that mean?
Well, it was the 100th one that was built as a national recreation trail. It got that designation. It was a special trail, specially designed as a national recreation trail. It had met certain standards to become a national trail. I don't know what they are.
Mm-hmm. But it must have been pretty important.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Of course, the National Forest is a lot of land when you consider the whole lot. Mm-hmm. In the west, most of the Rocky Mountains are National Forest. Mm-hmm. And the Pacific Crest Trail was one of the trails I got information from. Talked to the guy that laid out a lot of that on telephone and sent me his books and information about trails.
So what did you learn from that?
Well, a lot of things really, but nothing in particular. Mm-hmm. It's just what you should do and shouldn't do.
Just wisdom from the trail, maybe? Hmm? Wisdom from the trail, the experience, kind of?
Yeah, the Pacific Crest Trail, you know, goes from Canada to Mexico almost, mm-hmm. on the mountains. Yeah.
That's
of course, yeah, I think it's one of these all-purpose trails where you can ride a horse. But most of it's above the tree line. Mm-hmm. And that's a different sort of a thing.
Did you ever get inspiration from the Appalachian Trail?
I've been on the Appalachian Trail, and I wanted to have Appalachian Trail shelters. Have you been there?
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about, the little...
Three-sided
thing that you could weather a storm in. Well, because we had a supervisor who said we don't build any Appalachian Trail shelters, I tried to get the shelter to where you could utilize rock overhangs and things like that that would provide some of the same features, but couldn't really provide at all, because I think they also had facilities for restrooms and things like that. It's kind of nice, but maybe not necessary. But I don't like people going out and just making a big restroom out of the forest.
Keep it.
I got a letter from one of my... Turn this thing off. I'll tell you a funny story. I was got a letter from one of the girls I sent a copy of my poem book to, and she said she remembered going to the forest with me and hiking up to the bridge, National Bridge State Park, and she walked across the trail without any adult supervision, and how she got chewed out for doing that from me when she got back. She says she all went up on the Tater Knob fire tower, and she saw the toilet paper, and she asked where the restrooms were in the fire tower, and she says she figured it out when she saw the toilet paper in the treetops.
Yeah, that's true. I bet a lot of those fire tower people probably.
None of them have a restroom. None of them even had a potty chair.
Well, here, let me do one more thing. Let me ask, just make sure I have a copy of this. Describe, say, my name is, like what we did at the beginning.
Oh.
Just do that, but don't talk about all your history. Just say, my name is Vern Orndorff. I was born in blah, 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 blah. And I started working in the Forest Service until whatever, and I worked in the Shelter.
Okay. My name is Vern Orndorff. I was born in 1916 and worked in the Forest Service from 1962 to 1980. And
say when you worked in the Sheltoe Trace.
And I worked on the Sheltoe Trace as part of my duties with the National Forest Service as a landscape architect.
Mm-hmm. Well, hey, I think, well, why not? A lot of people get pictures of themselves in their work outfit. You worked there for 20 years. Well, then I'll probably want to get a picture of you. I'll probably want to bring my camera and get a picture of you. So I can just, I'll call you.
I've got some, pictures in here at the moment. There when I was in New Guinea.
Yeah.
I put my picture of myself with a beard when I was in New Guinea in the service.
Oh, yeah.
I was 4 years in the Army. It's been three of it in Australia and a year of it in New Guinea.
So that's when you were battle-hardened?
I was a weather observer, man.
Weather observer. Well, you were hardened by the weather. Experience with the...
I observed the weather. Nice day.